Karen Zapata, welcome to COVID Race and Democracy. Can you please introduce yourself and tell us what is most important for the listening audience to know about you?
Let's see. I'm a high school teacher. I started teaching in 1996. I taught in elementary schools for 17 years. I was a Spanish bilingual teacher back when Spanish bilingual was a thing. Now it's a lot of education around Spanish bilingual students is focused around immersion, Spanish immersion programs, but that was my introduction to teaching. And I was very focused on students maintaining their first language because for me, as the daughter of an immigrant father and my mother's white, so I, as a mixed race student in school, I felt very out of place. For me, it was very important. The reason I got into teaching was to create the conditions in which students felt proud of themselves. And that for me has been a long journey and one that I'm very focused on. That was my introduction into teaching. And then I started teaching high school. And right now I teach at Berkeley High. I'm also involved in teacher education programs. And more importantly, I'm a teacher organizer and I helped found an organization called Teachers for Social Justice that's here in the Bay Area. And I'm also a mother of two teenagers. And those are the important things to know.
Thank you for that. And you said you're involved in the teacher education through which institution is that?
Yeah, I'm an adjunct faculty at the University of San Francisco. So I help support teachers that are just entering the profession. We call them early career educators, I think they're called now. And I help train and support them for their future in this. And I hate to call it a profession. It's really a calling. This work is, I think it's sacred. I think it's incredibly personal and it has the potential to be incredibly transformative. So it's hard for me to call it a profession. To me, it's a calling and a commitment in a lot of ways.
So let's talk some about the impact of the pandemic. What are you seeing and hearing about how the pandemic is affecting education? And you could answer that from your own experience, but I'm also interested in what you're hearing about around the state and around the country.
The pandemic is affecting education much like it's affecting our country and our society and our world, really, which is to say that it has really stopped us in the tracks we were in. And in a lot of ways, it's an invitation. And as Arundhati Roy calls it, it's a portal. And it asks us where we are going to head next. And I think that in a lot of ways, for those of us involved in teaching for social justice or involved in the educational struggle for social justice, you know, the question really is, where do we go from here? And so a lot of us have been trying to, you know, reimagine classrooms. We've been trying to recreate and recarve our spaces to be liberatory, to be empowering for young people, to be places where young people are seen and recognized and valued for the unique people that they are. So this pandemic is an invitation. I think that's the way I try to look at it. It's also, I think the pandemic is sadly really disrupting the relationships on some level that we have with young people. And that's very distressing to teachers. I teach every day to a bank of blank screens. I mostly have one, maybe two students on screen, and the rest are just black boxes with their names on them. And so the way that I see, you know, that light in the eyes, or I connect with you, I'm sitting next to you, talking to you about a poem that we're studying or an essay that was written. Those connections are sort of uprooted by this technical situation that we're in. So I think for a lot of us, it's really hard because our souls are really bought into connecting with young people, seeing them and, you know, and honestly with their families. So, you know, maybe we all sit down together and talk about you know, how we can support a young person, and the family sits down with the teacher, and now we're in a virtual environment, and it becomes a lot more difficult.
Appreciate that. The Bay Area is not exactly typical of everywhere else in the country. What are you hearing around the country in terms of who is being well served and who is not during the pandemic around education?
You know, I mean, I think that that's one of the difficulties. I'm going to be honest. I think that in terms of teacher organizing, a lot of energy right now is going into people trying to kind of make it through the day. And so, you know, honestly, I can't tell you what is happening around the country. I know what's happening in the Bay Area. And I think I could have told you earlier what's happening in different parts of the country in terms of what's happening in people's classrooms. But our communities have been kind of disconnected through this as well, to be honest. So my sense is that there's a lot of fear right now, that there's a lot of fear, particularly in terms of how we go back, how we're urged to go back, and whether or not it's safe. I think our community is really, the educational justice activist community is focused, I guess the organizing is not in a place that it used to be.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is understandable.
Let me just quickly give you an example, which is that, you know, every year we do a conference which has, you know, serves almost 2,000 educators from around the Bay, as well as around the country and the state. This was our 20th annual, and so we actually ended up doing an online version, a virtual conference, but the amount of energy it took to repurpose the entire thing and recreate a space, a virtual space for us to do the conference was incredibly taxing. Our conference is sort of a well-oiled machine because we've been doing it so long. So we know where, you know, someone's got the boxes in their basement and we have a bank of volunteers. Well, this turned everything on its head. So I think as organizers, we've needed to create some new strategies that have cost a lot of time and energy.
Yeah, those conferences are great, by the way. I've been to quite a few of them. And I can't imagine really what it would involve to redo. I mean, because those had like, the ones I went to did have several thousand people at them. So yeah. I don't know how you kind of turn that around to an online, I mean, all the kinds of breakouts and logistics.
It was very different. Really was.
If I were to pick up the newspaper and find an education story, the most likely story I would see is something that is talking about when should schools reopen or should they continue to do online learning? And then, you have people on one side saying, we can't do the online learning. It's just destroying kids in so many different ways in their education. Mm-hmm. It's creating disparities. Yeah. It's setting kids back. They're not learning. And then on the other hand, you have people saying, yeah, but you're endangering students, teachers, communities. If you don't get them back into the schools as soon as possible, and we just have to have that. And it's like, that's the two poles of the debate is like, do either do online instruction or go back to school and kind of do the same traditional way of instructing that you were doing before the pandemic. What's wrong with that framing, and how might we think about that differently?
I think the biggest issue and something that is very talked about right now, especially in the educational activist community, is the real critical importance of teachers being able to listen, and particularly listening to Black and Brown communities. There is a lot of people speaking on behalf of communities of color. And oftentimes they are people that are using communities of color, using narratives of equity that they really didn't hold this issue of equity or serving Black and Brown students and getting educational equity in schools before the pandemic. So Interestingly, in Berkeley in particular, there's a community of white privileged families that are speaking on behalf of communities of color saying we need to reopen our schools. And so the question, I think, is how are we connecting with our families? What relationships are we building? What are the levels of communication? And I think if we listened, we would hear that our schools really do need to change, that they have served certain students really well, and there are other students that they have not served well. And that's what racist outcomes look like in our school system. And so it is a call for change. I think that, like I said about Arundhati Roy's framing of the pandemic as a portal, so in what way are we turning schools into places that Black and brown students are going to return to, thrive, grow, find their voice, and transform our world? And unless we're willing to do that, we are just saying, let's go back to where we started. And many of us don't want to go back there and have been working for a long time to disrupt what used to be. And so I think that in our organization, we've been working a lot with the idea of freedom dreaming, which comes from the Black radical tradition, which is, what dreams do we have for our world? What dreams do we have for the young people in our classrooms? And so if this portal is open, what might the future look like? So I think that that framework is really problematic. Do we continue to do online learning? It's working for some students and it's not working for others. There are students that have had a really hard time in classrooms, and this has been a break for them. And then there are students that really are eager to get back. I don't think that anyone has the idea that this is great. This virtual, world is working for us. On the other hand, do we want to go back to what it was? Absolutely not. And what does our future look like? What freedom dreams do we have for the young people? What does it look like for Black, brown, Indigenous students to thrive in a classroom is really where our energy should be.
Can we go a little deeper into that? So mm-hmm. when you and others do that dreaming or visioning, mm-hmm. what are some of the key issues and some of the key demands that emerge from that?
The first is sort of a basic one around, this isn't a huge stretch, which is to really dismantle the testing system in our schools. And what we know is that the tests that young people are taking in schools, and particularly the tests for Black and brown young people, are tied to a very problematic past of, our eugenic history in our school systems and our public health systems, which sort of serve to calculate and measure the intelligence of young people as a predictor of potential. And those histories inform us testing in schools is inappropriate. It's unjust. And so I think that as a ground floor, we really need to get rid of standardized tests. We need to get rid of the idea of measuring young people and instead open up a world of possibility and potential, and to see each young person as having deep and endless potential. And so the way that our testing system, number one, works by, robbing the humanity of young people, but also in terms of the incredible wealth machine that it is for companies like Pearson, and we really don't have a place for profit in when we talk about the potential of young people or educating young people for liberation or looking towards a future that has young people thriving. The for-profit testing systems are not a part of that. So I think that's the ground floor. And then I think beyond that, I really believe our schools need to be deeply connected to our communities. So pretend this community is really struggling with, for example, food security. How can our schools be the places in which that's researched, investigated, thought about, and then young people are engaged with the community in developing food securities? So they're vibrant members of a community that cares, and they're problem solving. That's what we need for our world. We need problem solvers. And yet we never put young people in the classroom in the position of solving problems. Instead, we test them, we deliver curriculum, you know, that we somehow have thought about and come up with, and we don't engage them in these deep problems that exist in our communities. Rather, we have these sort of, you know, pre-thought of curricula. We've got a unit that we've already sort of mapped out, and we've got these assessments like writing a paper. You know, it's like writing a paper that I read. It's so insular, right? It just exists within the four walls of the school. Rather, you know, in my freedom dream, what that looks like is, let's take a look at what's happening in our communities. Let's engage young people as problem solvers and have those questions at the center of what we're teaching and learning together, what we're investigating, what we're thinking deeply about. And then let's get out there and interact with our communities.
I appreciate that. And actually, I want to tie that to what you were saying earlier for a second, because I thought it was very insightful what you said about the ways that those who are pushing the elements of the neoliberal corporate education agenda, like standardized testing, are very sophisticated about using the language of serving, of school reform and serving students of color. When you listen to these education conversations, a lot of times, if you don't know what organization somebody works with or what their program is, you could be listening to anybody on the spectrum because they're all using the same language.
Yeah.
You know, everybody has mastered the language, but then what's behind that, the solutions are very, very different. And standardized testing and standardized curriculum is a key piece of that agenda. Now, to kind of bring us up to where we are now, I know that before the pandemic, there was a growing activist movement. Parents were opting out. I think in New York, there were tens of thousands of parents that took their kids out of the testing regimen, et cetera. What's happened to that whole testing issue under the pandemic? Have states backed off to some extent because of the conditions? And have activists been able to keep that momentum going against it?
I think that's one of the most exciting things I would say, is that I think we're headed to a real disruption of the testing system. There are, you know, there are universities right now that are, you know, creating college acceptance programs that do not include standardized tests. And that the question was begged by us being unable to sit young people in these rooms with these pieces of paper and these high stakes, horrible, you know, experiences. I've proctored these things, you know, these young people are sweating, you know, the stakes are so incredibly high. And they really don't have to do with the, like I said, the sort of sacred potential that each young person and each human being has within them, no matter what their mind or their body or their cognition looks like. I actually really think that that's what's ahead of us. I will say there are local efforts to opt students out, and the state has a stranglehold on us, because if a certain amount of young people opt out of a standardized test at a school site, that school has the potential to lose funding. And every school that I've ever taught at, I have communicated this opt-out issue to the families, but the school is caught in this double bind whereby they, you know, I think on one level, they want the, they want the families to know that this is an option for them, but they also can't, because they will lose federal funding or state funding. It's one of the two, by these families opting out. So again, if we talk about the pandemic as creating an entirely new sort of foundation that we're going to stand on, I want to think that because we were able to operate schools last year without tests, you know, they didn't give the standardized tests in our public schools. Why go back? Why do we need to go back when we've already done it a year? So I actually think that this is deeply promising. I want to think it's deeply promising that our communities will start to rally behind disrupting the incredibly profitable and corrupt testing machine.
And are there any other either issues or organizations where you see some momentum right now, either some kind of innovative models that are being developed that are more along the lines of social justice education and instruction, mm-hmm. or where there is actually some momentum to overturn policies that have reproduced inequity? Are there any specific either organizations or issues that you're seeing under the pandemic are taking off?
I think that our unions are so important. And, you know, this is one of those false dichotomies that oftentimes is kind of created by, you know, quote unquote, social justice teaching, which is that there can be created this paradigm that, you know, if you're a social justice teacher, you're committed to the community and you're going to sort of turn your back on the organizing that a union does. And I really think that is incredibly false. And unfortunately, it is sort of a paradigm in our teacher activist communities at times. But more so than often, our, you know, social justice educators are involved in their teachers' unions. They're involved, they're organizing. I myself helped found a part of the local teacher, Berkeley Teachers Union, called the Racial Equity Committee. We've started a parent listening campaign with Black families. We're reading Black Lives Matters at School as a community. And so I think a lot of us see our unions as sites to continue to organize. And that's really important because an organized labor force is really important for our students. It's important for our lives as educators and for our communities. If I go back to this false dichotomy of teacher organizing is bad for student learning or bad for equity, it's a very false paradigm. And I think it actually serves to benefit those in power. You know, they sort of divide us. So I myself am deeply involved in my union. Most of the educational activists that I'm organizing with are involved in their union. So I think that that's one thing that I think is really important is that we as social justice educators recognize both the critical importance of how our unions organize and we're involved in the teachers' unions that serve our districts. I think we could also do, you know, more to involve our families and the parents that we serve and the children and the young people that we serve. I guess outside of the unions being an incredibly important part of social justice teaching and the work that needs to happen to get us out of this or to move us into a new world beyond the pandemic, I think really the issue I'm going to continue to go back to is freedom dreaming. I think it really has to do with creating a world in which we can see the potential in every young person, that we can create the conditions where communities are thriving and our schools are serving the communities in which they exist. And the young people are seen as problem solvers. Our schools are seen as an integral part of the community rather than a place where my child is surveyed, you know, a place where my child goes and I have to shore them up and reteach them when they get home and fight the, you know, the educators and the administrators and fight the policing that happens to them in those four walls. So I think that really a lot of us are involved in re-envisioning a new world, and that new world involves our unions. You know, the new world involves disrupting the way that young people are treated in schools.
Thank you for that. Again, keeping in mind that we have listeners around the country, are there particular organizations around the country, social justice, education, grassroots organizations, or teachers unions that you feel on the national level are really leading some of these battles? And if people wanted to either get more information or get involved, that you could suggest?
Yeah, I think a lot of us in the social justice teaching sphere are involved right now in a lot of, it's almost like we're in this sort of think tank phase where we're really thinking a lot about the framework of abolition, the framework of ending systems of oppression within, you know, our education system, ending policing in schools, ending the over-surveillance of Black and brown bodies in our schools. And so a lot of sort of thinking is happening right now. And I would say many of the social justice organizations are doing things like holding conferences, holding online events, webinars, and a lot of really important analysis is happening right now. You know, our organization, Teachers for Social Justice, we did a series, a three-month series that looked at what we called unsettling settler colonialism. It also looked at centering Black lives. And so each month we had a different theme. I would also say the Abolitionist Teaching Network is an amazing resource. Again, doing a lot of the articulation of abolitionist teaching strategies. They're supporting classroom educators, and as well as the Education for Liberation Network, another incredibly important social justice teaching organization. I think those are the ones that I want to mention right now that come to the top of my mind, but I can also send you more if I think of them.
Those are great. We actually had Bettina Love on our part one show from the Abolitionist Teaching Network.
Which is amazing.
Inspirational, yeah. Totally. You know, increasingly people are familiar with abolitionism as applied to the criminal justice, quote unquote, system. But I don't know that people outside of the education circles are very aware of that concept of abolitionist teaching and how that connects. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yes. If we think of abolition as interrupting systems of oppression, our school system is a system of oppression. It's a system of reproduction of the status quo. And so if we are not careful, our schools continue to produce the same results over and over. And it's what all the hand-wringing is and the anguish about racist outcomes in our classrooms. And it's what we were talking about a little earlier in terms of the way that Pearson and these educational, for-profit educational companies are able to use words like, you know, achievement gap or, you know, opportunity gap or equity and get away with it. And so we're all swimming in the sea of inequity, and yet really disrupting that, really to enact abolitionist teaching means to create classrooms that disrupt the idea or disrupt systems of oppression. They disrupt, you know, the way that young people are tested, the way that they are controlled, the way that they are seen in our classrooms as, you know, needing to be retaught, needing to be remediated, needing to be corrected. And instead, what our classrooms ideally do is they are sites of openings. They're sites of creating opportunities for young people to speak their mind, say, this is what I'm interested in learning about, and then learning about that. Right now, what we do is we really mirror our societies and our classrooms. So there are certain people, there are certain students that are, what is the word, controlled. There are, you know, the young people, the Black and brown young people are, you know, sort of controlled and told what to do. And they're the ones that are sent out into the hallways. And so really what abolitionist teaching does is it says, it turns our classrooms on their head, you know, ideally. It reframes everything and it says, you know, how can I operate from your strengths, from your wisdom, from your beauty, from your knowledge? And rather than having an idea that, you know, I'm going to recreate this person, how can I teach from what you know and learn from you? So I think that abolitionist teaching, you know, the idea is it's about freedom, right? It's about freedom in our classrooms from control. It's about freedom from overly scripted, remediated spaces to spaces of curiosity and creating spaces where young people can thrive and think on their own and have sovereignty. But we are so far away from that right now. You know, we are so far away. We come up with all these ideas of what we want, you know, young people to learn, and we don't listen to both young people as well as their communities. What are their communities? What dreams do our young people's communities have for them? And especially, what dreams do Black and Brown families have for their children? And how can we operate from that place if we really want to be anti-racist, if we really want to disrupt systems of oppression? How can we be in community? How can we be in conversation? And how can we listen and operate from the dreams that our families have for their young people? And like I said, in particularly Black and Brown families. And historically, when the abolition movement was alive, there were accomplices. There were white accomplices that, you know, in a variety of ways, supported the work to end slavery. And so what kind of accomplice are our teachers being now? So, you know, that framework of abolition includes everyone. But it turns our system from a space of educational silencing to an opening for liberation and freedom.
Very powerfully said. Thank you, Karen, for that.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you want to address that I haven't asked you about?
Let's see. I think that I want to say something about my teaching. And that is that this year, because like I said, I believe it's a portal, this year, I taught a unit on, you know, I'm an English teacher, so I taught a unit on powerful writing. And the way that I taught that unit on powerful writing was I had the young people that I was working with write speeches. And we learned about, you know, ethos, pathos, and logos, and all those literary terms and the way that powerful language is used. And they wrote speeches about the things that they care about. They wrote speeches about defunding the police. They wrote speeches about reproductive rights. They wrote speeches about disability justice. And the assessment that I gave them, instead of, you know, writing a speech and turning it into me, like, what is that? It's so insular. And instead, they were required to give the speech to their families or to their grandma or to, you know, in a Zoom meeting with their communities, or posted on social media. And we hosted a night at an online, a virtual event, where a variety of young people actually gave the speeches to our community. And so we invited the teachers and a couple families. And so right now I'm really interested in really getting outside of just turning in things to me, and how is this serving? Number one, how is it helping young people articulate what they really care about, which is the state of our world? And then who is that audience? Because me, as the teacher being the audience, I am such a small part. So how is it that we're asking young people to interact with their communities through our schools? And then I'll just give you another example, which is the other unit I'm teaching right now, which is on epidemiology and vaccines. And so what I've asked the students that I'm working with right now is to write, we've researched COVID, we've looked at the coronaviruses and SARS-CoV-2 and the vaccines. And I've just asked them, is the vaccine worth it? And I've taught them enough for them to be able to answer that question. And now they're creating educational pieces. They're creating social media content. They're creating recorded presentations that they're going to be sharing with their families and their communities about whether the vaccine is worth it. And their communities need to know what they've learned. They need to know, you know, whether the vaccine is worth it and what they've learned about COVID. And so the more information that we have out there, the better. And that's what the young people are involved in. So through the unit we're teaching right now, it's really about outreaching and teaching others so that what they're learning is paid forward. I mean, I guess I just want to use my own classroom and my own practice as a spot to say that, you know, this is what our school systems really need to be about. What's happening in our world? How can we help young people make their own decision about our ways forward, and how can we help them get the word out about that?
Those are just such wonderful examples. Thank you for sharing those. Yeah. Is there a way for people who want to learn more or get active to get in touch with Teachers for Social Justice?
Yeah, the website t4sj.org has a bunch of resources as well as ways to contact us. So it's www.t4sj.org. And in that website is a whole list of, actually there's an online newsletter that we have. We have an email blast, and we also host links to other sites as well. So,
and that's a national organization?
Teachers for Social Justice is really a local organization, but, you know, lots of national folks access us as well. But
right. And the other two you mentioned, the Abolitionist Teaching Network and Education for Liberation, those are national, right?
Correct.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
Those are both national.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for all of this insight and inspiration, Karen. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Ken. It was good to talk to you.
You as well.